This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me is Joyce Goh and also Koo Soo Chung. And also Brian Fernandez is giving us a little teaser of what's coming up after the 8 o'clock bulletin. We have the Breakfast Grill and our guest this morning, Olivier Blaringham, Vice President of for Asia Pacific for Subsea 7, a subsea engineering and construction services company.
Yeah, so they're a company that's interesting. I'm looking forward to speaking to Olivier. They've got a very strong balance sheet. A couple of key questions I'm going to be asking him. How they're surviving in a $50 US dollar oil environment. Malaysia is also their hub for Asia Pacific. So we're going to see what they're going to do, what their expansion plans are. And also, because of their strong balance sheet, they've been quite active in the M&A space. So let's ask him whether they're looking to buy any Malaysian companies.
Okay, let's subsea and wait for that breakfast grill that's coming up after the 8 o'clock bulletin. Now, let's go to cryptocurrencies. It's because a story that's been grabbing headlines off and on. But what do we know now, and where is what's the state of play at the moment with cryptocurrencies, Chuang?
Well, basically the news over the last few days as we were in holiday mode was that the Chinese PBOC, which is the regulator over there, they've basically deemed illegal initial coin offerings, which is very much the rage in fundraising circles now. Basically, this is the issuance of tokens against the company's usage of blockchain technology to raise funds for its growth. Now, of course, the PBOC's deeming of illegal of cryptocurrencies being illegal, and specifically Bitcoin, stands in stark contrast to Japan's adoption of Bitcoin in cryptocurrencies. As we understand right now, three big Japanese banks, like the MUFJ, Mizuho, and Sumitomo as well, have all backed Bitflyer, which is the country's version, and which is the largest Bitcoin exchange. So cryptocurrencies generally are very much in a state of flux, and it's been very, very volatile. When I look at CoinMarketCap.com, which is basically the de facto exchange and platform for assessing prices, Bitcoin dropped by 7% overnight to $4,257 per coin. Ethereum's are down below $300 at $297, give or take, down 14%. Bitcoin Cash, which is the third largest by market cap terms, is at about $523 per Bitcoin Cash, down 13%. So it's very, very volatile in the cryptocurrency world right now, and is driven really by the Chinese stance on cryptos.
Right. I think I can see, well, after the Chinese said on their website on Monday that it had completed investigations into initial coin offerings and they say that these are illegal, you can see the Bitcoin tumbling. And I can understand that perhaps they're looking at more regulation. They want more regulation, more certainty to this whole cryptocurrency thing that I guess to them it might have expanded beyond, you know, control in a way.
But what's going to stop somebody in China investing in Bitcoin? Is this a space that can be regulated?
They're trying, perhaps.
Well, yeah, you see, the thing is, the perspective here is that the biggest game in town the last couple of decades has been the whole central bank phenomenon. Central banks basically control the supply of money, they control the price of money, and everybody in global markets are waiting on tenterhooks for the latest comment or the latest remark from Janet Yellen or Raghuram Rajan, Ben Bernanke, Tan Sri Zeti, Mohamed Ibrahim. So, you know, basically central banks dictate prices and capital flows all around the world, and for them to potentially lose the omnipresence because of cryptocurrencies is a big deal for them, right? Because cryptocurrencies, and by their very nature, they're one of the central tenets is the whole issue of decentralization, the bypassing of central overseers, you see. So
yeah,
it's a usurpation, if there's such a word, of their omnipresence.
But what about the question of, you know, dark money, money connected to the criminal underworld, to, you know, to terrorism? I mean, can't they use conduit like this, like cryptocurrencies, also to move money around for their nefarious agendas?
Perhaps there are concerns there. So coming back to your question, Sharad, on whether China can look into regulating this, I think they have come out to say that they will strictly punish offerings in the future, such ICO offerings, and penalize violations in ones that have already been completed. And they also said that those who have already raised money through this way, they must provide refunds. So they are looking to look into regulating this in a way.
Oh, and actually China even dialing back on people who've on those companies that are getting that money back
perhaps,
into China.
But they didn't specify how much money will be paid back to investors, but they did say that there should be refunds for this.
Well, it's a bit like how, you know, in response to your question on you know, illegal use and nefarious activities, in India last year, they tried to outlaw cash or basically the large currencies of 500 and 1,000 rupiahs on the basis on the basis that they were, you know, used very much in illegal activities, fraudulent activities and by crime syndicates. And I think that is the central argument in favor of, you know, on cash or on cryptocurrencies. But, you know, crime finds a way. It's a bit like Jurassic Park. Life finds a way.
Water finds its level. Speaking of the former governor of the bank, Reserve Bank of India, Raghuram, he's just come up with a book and he's criticized that move by the Modi government. And in fact, there's been quite a bit of criticism the last couple of days on the effects on the economy
following
the demonetization. Yeah. But anyway, let's leave India aside for the moment. Let's take a look at conditions, business conditions in Malaysia based on some of the key indicators that we have before us, including tax collection and such.
Well, business has never been more challenging or more opportunistic. And if you look at the challenges perspective, right now you've got the Inland Revenue Board being very, very vocal in terms of its tax collection targets. 128 billion ringgit for 2017. They've collected about 77 billion ringgit so far. And we've basically got about 3.5 months left in the year. And it's not going to get any easier. They're going to step up efforts to collect more taxes from individuals as well as corporations. And the latest news flow is that the Inland Revenue Board are going after the professionals, the architects, the accountants, the lawyers, the engineers, which, according to their tax audits and investigations, have been very much able to avoid, not necessarily evade, but avoid paying taxes the last few years.
And tax avoidance is not a crime, by the way, is it?
Tax planning, perhaps. tax planning, perhaps, could be okay. But tax evasion, it is a no-no in that sense. So, I think there's a general feel that RRB has been stepping up on their whole tax audit and investigations, first on corporates, now it looks like it's on individuals. But then again, I think after speaking to tax experts, you can understand that. They say, although we noticed that there's a big increase like this year, this has partly to do with also due to technology and data analysis, RRB is able to look for red flags. You know, looking at data analysis, your tax filing, and comparing that to your employer's tax expenses, you know, things like that. Like, and then from there, they can look at red flags and say, hey, perhaps this person is not really declaring their income as they should. And then they zoom in into that.
So I hope they take their time coming to journalists, though.
I think journalists got no money. Last on the list.
Low down the food chain. I don't think we're the lowest of the low, but certainly there at the bottom of the food chain. But what else do we know about what this is signaling about the health of the Malaysian economy?
We're not special, right, Joyce? Because it's a global crackdown,
right?
I mean, we've seen the tax inversion measures by Google and Facebook, you know, putting offices and operations in Ireland, you know, far-flung reaches of the universe to, you know, take advantage of more lenient and generous tax regimes.
In fact, we have the Panama Papers, you know, debacle. Remember when a lot of private negotiations and management of incomes were done that way and wealth? And that, of course, kind of raised the conversation for all of us, the difference between tax evasion and tax management, as you put
efficient
it.
I thought I saw your name there, Shishrad. You're number 72 on the list, aren't you?
Yeah, I wish. Remember, I'm a journalist.
Yeah. So the RRB is looking to aim to collect about 127 billion in direct taxes this year. That's about 10% to the national GDP. Compare that to developed countries, it's actually 14%. So we're still lower than developed countries when it comes to how much taxes they collect.
Yeah, so corporations might, issue a hue and cry. But at the end of the day, when collected and when spent prudently and wisely, that's the big joinder there. Tax is, you know, good for the economy, necessary for the economy, right?
Okay. Now, what about public holidays? Are they necessary for the economy?
Well, you tell me. we've just come off a five-day-long sojourn.
And my television and all my television services went offline.
Yeah.
Can you mean midway through this five-day weekend? So I was quite miserable. But coming back to the question of, say, productivity, for instance, and there have been some voices raised about the excessive use of public holidays as gifts to the public. I mean, how do we actually get a better sense of what that is?
So this is the business conundrum. On the one hand, the government and IRB want to collect more corporation tax and individual tax from Malaysians, right? And you've got to step it up and you've got to produce more stuff. The other thing is, if you want to produce more stuff and get more income and revenue and have a step up in quarterly earnings, you've also got to deal with the fact that Malaysia is one of the most public holiday countries in the world. And we've just had another one given to us.
An unscheduled one,
ad hoc. So, you know, people like Tan Sri Lim Wee Chai, he's the chairman and CEO of Top Glove Corporation. He's done his sums. And he said every public holiday in the country is going to cost the country 1.5 billion ringgit. I don't know the basis of his calculations, but it seems to be quite a lot of money, right, in terms of output.
Yeah,
because factories, they don't stop. You know, factories, machines, they don't stop.
Right, I think, but there are some who actually, they did work yesterday, but the employers give like a day, they add on a day to your leave. So it's not exactly like a total write-off there.
Right.
Like,
so, people, but it's a monetary value, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I have a question. For me, I feel like it. How do you measure productivity with public holidays? So, I mean, some people can stay back late in the office and be on Facebook and Twitter the whole time and not do work. So I mean, that's my question, right? How can you measure productivity with being in the office? I mean, sometimes, like for us over the weekend, we're not in the office, but you still have to...
Yeah.
To be
I'm very productive when I'm at the office, I must say. We did a poll about who wanted this extra Monday holiday, and you know, 60% of our listeners, we had over 300 people voting, said they didn't want an extra holiday, and you had doctors talking about you having
rescheduled. Are they bosses or what?
Well, this is it, right? So everybody said they're bosses. So
the perspective is that public holidays are bad for employers and business owners because you want your people to be working, not having a sojourn and sipping daiquiris on the beach. But if you're an employee or a member of staff,
sipping daiquiris. But what about this? What if you make the argument that in fact increases in productivity haven't resulted in a bigger wage packet for the every,
correct? So that's
right.
Most workers.
So it's the same thing in America, right? People are expected to work harder, but there's a little or no discernible impact on the wage growth. And it's the same thing in Malaysia. There's been a stagnation on income growth.
Speaking of stagnation, glass ceiling for women. The Prime Minister's come out, says he's going to help break that glass ceiling. What do you think?
Well, you know, the whole issue is really diversity of boards and basically having more perspectives and more complexions on company boards. Right now, it's very much a male-driven framework. And I think the Prime Minister is right in pointing out that there's a long way to go in terms of gender diversity on Malaysian corporate boards. The larger issue, I think, is really a question of whether it should be organic and merit-driven or whether it should be policy-driven and top-down. And the Prime Minister has said that if you don't adhere and comply with the 30% target by a certain date, I think next year, they will name and shame the companies.
I think women account to about 17.9% on the boards of directors in the top 100 public listed companies on Bursa. Yeah, this is for June this year. I think it's great. It's a great move by the PM. I understand it's based on merit, which is good.
I understand that too, and I'm supporting you all the way, Joyce Goh, there, in your struggle for women. Okay, coming up after the news, shortly the news, because after that we'll have the Breakfast Grill. Olivier Blaringham, Vice President of Asia Pacific for Subsea 7 in Engineering Construction Services Company with Brian Fernandez. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.